Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we're looking at Chapter 6 of Ellen G. White's book, The Great Hope. Click the card in the corner or the link in the description to watch this whole series as a playlist. This chapter is called True Peace, and the main thrust seems to be Ellen pulling the no true Christian thing, but as a chapter instead of just scattered throughout the chapters like she's done in the other ones. Because of that, I am going to be skipping over quite a bit of this one. It's very similar to a lot of stuff that I've already covered, but there are some things that I want to say about it, so let's take a look! So, remember how I said I'd be skipping a bunch? Yeah, the first page and a half is essentially nothing but real Christians do X, but fake Christians do Y. So I don't really have anything to say there, as I'm of the opinion that Christianity as a whole is fake, so there's no such thing as a real one. Except I wouldn't really put it in those terms. I'd say more that Christianity as a whole is untrue, and so figuring out which Christian is a true Christian is an exercise in futility at best. May as well just treat them all as though they sincerely believe it. And amusingly enough, after I skip these pages because it's all about people being true Christians, I am now responding to a few things she says in the next section, which is literally called True Followers of Christ. So, whoops.
Whoops.
Whoopsie.
She opens the section by saying, despite the widespread decline in faith, there are true followers of Christ in these churches. Before God finally brings his judgments, among the people of the Lord there will be a revival of authentic godliness not seen since the time of the apostles. First and foremost, this shows that Christians worrying about the decline of Christianity is not a new phenomenon. And while it is largely declining in the developed world, worldwide it is on the rise, thanks largely to the Christian aversion to family planning. But I suppose that's where the no true Scotsman thing comes in handy. Christianity is declining! I mean, actually, if you look at the numbers, it's still growing. Yeah, maybe, but those aren't true Christians, so Christianity is on the decline. And there's no way you can prove me wrong there. This stems from the Christian persecution complex. The author of John had Jesus proclaiming that the world would hate and persecute his followers in chapter 15, verses 19 and 20. The last of the Beatitudes in Matthew 5 are, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," and, "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Paul reinforced those statements in his letters, though he was frequently writing about specific events that would be fresh in the memories of the people he was writing to, but often he made reference to the fact that persecution of Christians is to be expected. So the Bible tells us that true Christians get persecuted for their faith. It's a bit of a problem for modern Christians living in a world where the government of the most powerful nation on the planet is overwhelmingly run by Christians, to the point where every other religion except for Judaism is underrepresented if you look at the proportion of their representation to their proportion in the public. As of January 2023, Congress was 87.8% Christian, compared to the 63% of the general population that are Christian. They're also 6.2% Jewish, with Jews making up 2% of the population, but every other religion is underrepresented, and none as egregiously as the unaffiliated category, with them making up 29% of the population, but only 0.2% of Congress. So Christians are supposed to be persecuted, but that would result in a religion that's not very popular, so probably would shrink. But Christianity is growing, and Christians are at the helm of government, not just in the United States, but in several countries. The Prime Minister of Canada is a Christian, the UK literally still has a monarchy that is the figurehead of both the country and the Church of England, though that is more symbolic than anything, as is shown by the fact that the current Prime Minister is Hindu, and was appointed by the head of the Church of England, King Charles. You know, because technically the Prime Minister is appointed by the reigning monarch, it just so happens that the reigning monarch always chooses to appoint the leader of the party that has the majority in the House of Commons after an election. Funny how that works. Andorra and Lebanon both have laws requiring that their head of state be Christian, though in the interest of full disclosure, Lebanon also requires that the Prime Minister is a Sunni Muslim. Several countries have Christianity as their official religion, like Armenia, Argentina, Greece, Tonga, Zambia, and a bunch more. So this whole "we have to be persecuted" thing doesn't really work with the fact that Christians are literally in charge of some of the most powerful countries in the world and are actively working in those countries to pass legislation that effectively renders Christians a privileged class. So how are we to deal with this discrepancy? Easy. Those aren't true Christians. The true Christians really are being persecuted. And that's basically what she says. Satan wants to interfere with this work, and before the time for such a movement arrives, he will try to prevent it by bringing in a counterfeit. Satan invented fake Christianity in order to maintain the persecution of the true Christians. And then comes a bunch of moral decline, fear-mongering, you know, same spiel that literally every generation has had to endure. And somehow, in spite of all this moral decline, we wound up in a place where all humans are supposed to have equal rights, regardless of sex, gender, race, orientation, religion, etc. I'd say that's morally superior to the "people with this skin color get to own people with that skin color" of previous generations. But I mean, what do I know? I'm a product of this morally depraved society that frowns on things like slavery, after all. But now we get a big section explaining to us how God's law, that restricts everything about our lives from what we wear to what foods we can eat to who we're allowed to marry, is actually a law of liberty somehow. By restricting all these arbitrary aspects of our lives, we are set free, you see. It's all quite Orwellian. This section opens by saying, "Many religious teachers claim that Christ abolished the law by his death. Some say it is a heavy yoke, and in contrast to the bondage of the law, they present the liberty that the gospel supposedly grants us to enjoy." And, well, yes, Jesus did indeed say that he has not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. He also said, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Which is interpreted by many mainstream Christians, including the ones over at gotquestions.org, who I now feel obligated to remind you that they once answered a question of why God didn't destroy Satan with what amounted to, "How dare you question God." Anyway, this verse is usually interpreted to mean that the yoke of following all of God's stringent requirements in the Old Testament is lifted through Jesus. I don't know how Ellen interprets this verse, but surely she'd tell us that this is one of those inventive interpretations that she warned us about in a previous chapter. But since she never tells us her interpretation, while clearly using the same language as the verse, I'm left assuming that one of three scenarios is true. First, what she thinks of as the proper interpretation seemed so obvious that she didn't need to bother explaining it. Second, she does explain it, either in a later chapter or in one of the chapters of the larger book that these were snipped from that didn't make the cut, so didn't feel the need to reiterate here, and the editors of this one also didn't feel the need to add a footnote explaining it. Or third, she couldn't think of an alternate interpretation, so she tried to give the impression that the alternate interpretation is obvious by obliquely referencing the verse without explaining it. Later in this section, she says, "If it had been possible to change the law or set it aside, Christ would not have needed to die to save us from the penalty of sin." There's two problems with that statement. First, in Matthew 19:26, Jesus himself says, "With man this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible." So to say that setting the law aside is impossible is to contradict what God himself actually said. Second, God literally set the law aside in Isaiah 43:24 and 25 when he said, "You have not bought me sweet cane with money or satisfied me with the fat of your sacrifices, but you have burdened me with your sins. You have wearied me with your iniquities. I am he who blots out your transgressions for my own sake, and I will not remember your sins." So we have God explicitly stating here that these people have not been repentant. They have not offered the appropriate sacrifices. But God has decided to set the law aside and forgive them, even if it's only for his own sake rather than theirs. Thus we see that it is most definitely possible for God to set the law aside. So by Ellen's own admission, Christ did not need to die to save us from the penalty of sin. God just had to be less of a jerk. But now she starts doing something that she warned against near the beginning of the book, quoting a verse out of context. And she does so in the most egregious form of context removal, in my opinion. She quotes Matthew 5:17 and 18 as saying, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law. Till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle shall by no means pass from the law." She took out the middle of the verse, where Jesus said, "I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Like, that's the worst kind of quote mining you can do, where you actually have to chop out the middle of a quote to make your point. And honestly, this kind of puts me in a bit of a role reversal here. Normally, I bring this verse up to make the same point that Ellen is trying to make. If you're a Christian, Jesus said that you still need to follow the Old Testament laws. But when I do it, I'm at least honest about the "I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill" part of the verse. I think that's a nonsensical statement. I mean, how does one fulfill a law? Laws are things that you obey or disobey. Prophecies are things that you would fulfill. But modern preachers would suggest that this statement indicates that most of the Old Testament law can be safely discarded. Though, certainly they wouldn't phrase it that way. But while Ellen was at least honest enough to indicate in her book that there is a part of the verse that is missing, she makes no mention of what the missing part might say. And in my experience, such tactics are less than helpful. It suggests to me that she didn't have what she considers to be a good enough response to the claim that Jesus fulfilling the law meant that Christians no longer have to obey it, so she chose to ignore it instead. Maybe that's not the case, but it certainly appears that way for a first-time reader of Ellen's material who is actually familiar with this verse. Though again, in the interest of fairness, she does go on to quote Romans 13:10 as saying, "Love is the fulfillment of the law." Though she is once again removing context, and we can kind of tell by the fact that she had to capitalize "love" when it's not actually the beginning of the sentence. It's presented in a way that would lead the reader who is familiar with the verse about Jesus fulfilling the law to draw the connection between Jesus fulfilling the law and love being the fulfillment of the law. God is love, Jesus is God, Jesus fulfilled the law, boom, problem solved. But in context, Romans 13, 8-10 is basically giving us a shortcut to keeping the law ourselves. If you love everyone, then you're not going to do them harm, and so by not doing them any harm, you will be obeying the law of God. This is using the term fulfillment more in the sense of summarizing the law rather than being relevant to the Jesus sacrifice thing, meaning that you no longer have to obey God's law, which, again, to be fair, that is kind of the point that Ellen's trying to make here. You do still need to obey the law, but love is how you do that. But the way it's presented seems like a sneaky way of avoiding the fact that Jesus said that he fulfilled the law, with preachers interpreting that to mean that you no longer have to worry about fulfilling the law because he did it for you. And that's not what Ellen wants to say. At the end of the paragraph, she says that a law like this must be as long-lasting as its author, a statement that I'm sure could wind up with some deep philosophical discussions about what law even is, which I'm not going to even begin to have here. I'd just like to point out that it is more than a bit of a non sequitur. The length of time that an author exists for is completely irrelevant to the significance of that author's works, as well as how long these works will last. After all, we have holy books that are older than the Bible, which still have adherents today. If these holy books have shown greater endurance thus far than the Bible, then does that automatically mean that the gods of those holy books must also have existed for at least as long as the God of the Bible? No, of course not. That would be silly. The next section basically explains to us how the church uses guilt as a control mechanism. Like, not in those words, but it's about how people don't actually feel guilty about a lot of what the Bible considers to be sinful behavior, so the way you develop that sense of guilt is by comparing your character to God's law. She also makes the statement, "The law shows us our sin, but it provides no remedy. It declares that death is the reward of the transgressor." And while, yes, it is true that the Bible has the death sentence for all sorts of minor transgressions, like picking up sticks on the wrong day of the week, being gay, being a disobedient child, being the wrong religion, and even for being the victim of rape in certain circumstances, there are several remedies given for the non-death penalty sins. One such remedy is called, for reasons that I'm certain will be quite clear, a sin offering. There were different requirements for the offering depending on who did the sinning, but generally it's the sacrifice of an unblemished animal of some kind, whether it be a bull, goat, lamb, or what have you. Now, one wonders, if nobody pre-Jesus could successfully receive forgiveness for their sins, what is the point of a sin offering? Was God just pulling a prank?
Hey, Satan! Satan! Satan!
What?
You gotta check these out. I found these guys that, like, they think I'm, like, really awesome, and they just do whatever the fuck I tell them to do, no matter how crazy it is.
No way!
Yes way! Watch this. Hey! Hey, you! Peasant! Over there! Yeah, you! You! So I'm kind of, pissed about your, gardens. Yeah, gardens. That's I'm pissed about your gardens.
Our gardens?
Yeah, your gardeners. The way you plant the, barley right next to the
the beans.
Beans, yeah, I knew that. I was just testing you. Well, that angers me greatly, so I'm gonna need you to kill a goat and splatter its blood all over the place.
Why?
Don't question me. I am your god. Now go kill a goat and splash in its blood, or I will smite you.
Okay. Jeez, chill out. I'll do it.
Holy shit, I don't believe that worked.
I know, right?
It really doesn't make any sense. The next section begins what seems to be a difficulty for Ellen. She's attempting to explain how you still need to follow the Old Testament law, while saying that Jesus is how you get forgiveness for failing to follow that law, but the preachers who preach not to worry about the law are wrong, but also you shouldn't worry about not having been able to fully follow the law because Jesus forgives you. She spins around so fast here that it gets a bit dizzying, to be honest. So this section is about Martin Luther, the guy known for nailing his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Castle in Germany in an event that started the Protestant Reformation, and was also likely very less dramatic than is commonly portrayed. Historians largely agree that he probably just mailed his letter to the Archbishop without the public dramatics. Anyway, she points out that he used to be a monk that was obsessed with essentially torturing himself to atone for his sins, until one day a friend said to him, "Instead of torturing yourself on account of your sins, throw yourself into the Redeemer's arms. Trust him in the righteousness of his life, in the atonement of his death. The Son of God became man to give you the assurance of God's favor. Love him who first loved you." Now, there's a lot of ellipses in that quote that, given Ellen's treatment of biblical context so far in this chapter, I'm curious to check out, but ultimately it doesn't really matter. The point is, Luther self-tortured to atone for sin until someone told him that Jesus atoned for it, something that this monk was apparently unaware of at the time somehow. Seems odd, but let's go with it. And then this caused him to go on a crusade against the purchasing of indulgences, which culminated in the Protestant Reformation. And so begins her argument that you need not concern yourself over much with the fact that you are an evil sinner, because Jesus gives you the gift of forgiveness, and this gift is given freely and cannot be purchased with things like indulgences. But then she goes straight into the next section, arguing that we still need to obey all of God's law. And I find the language that she's using here to be rather amusing. She calls God's law a law of liberty frequently throughout the book, but she recognizes, at least in the beginning of this section, that having to obey a strict law is in fact a restriction, not a liberty, as this section is called, "Does forgiveness free us from obedience?" and opens with the question, are we now free to disobey God's law? Now, perhaps she did this on purpose to highlight the difference between how she defines freedom and how it is commonly understood, or perhaps this was simply an oversight on her part because of how the word freedom would be used colloquially. But either way, it shows an awareness that God's law is not, in fact, freedom, and that forcing obedience to any law is, by definition, a restriction of freedom, not a liberation. Now, certainly there are laws which, when applied at the population level, do increase overall freedom of the population, but they still do so by limiting the freedom of some. So, for instance, a law against murder restricts those who wish to commit murder, but it provides greater freedom for pretty much everyone else in the society, as they can now rely on a certain amount of legal protection against someone trying to murder them. Or how a law against, say, the state enforcing a specific religion increases the freedom of the whole population, as they are now free to practice their religion however they choose, without worrying about a state-mandated religion being thrust upon them. But at their core, even these laws that increase overall freedom do so by placing and enforcing restrictions on people. She quotes 1 John 5:3, which says, "This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." Which, I suppose, is to suggest that it shouldn't be hard to follow the law of God, but I have a confession to make here. When I had a vegetable garden, I regularly planted crops of different kinds right next to each other in clear violation of the law of God. I also regularly wear garments that are made of mixed fabrics, and I'm wearing some right now. That's another violation. I can frequently be found working on Sundays, or I guess Saturdays, given that Ellen's whole thing is that the Sunday Sabbath is wrong. The true Sabbath is from Friday evening to Saturday evening. And at this point, she doubles down on the "you don't feel guilt until after the church drills it into you" thing by saying, "Without the law, people have no true conviction of sin and feel no need to repent. They do not realize how much they need the atoning blood of Christ." So you don't need to feel guilty because Jesus has atoned for you, but you need to feel guilty for having broken the law because you're supposed to keep the law, and not feeling guilty when you break the law is a bad thing. But Martin Luther feeling guilty all the time and punishing himself for breaking the law was also a bad thing, and round and round and round we go. The next section deals with the idea of sanctification. She says, "The Bible clearly teaches what sanctification is and how we can attain it," followed by several paragraphs of Bible quotes using the word sanctify in sentences that don't explain what it is or how to attain it, leaving us to work that out from context. You'd think that if the Bible clearly teaches what it is, you could just quote the verse that does that. You know, like how I can say that the Bible clearly teaches that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the convictions of things not seen, by quoting Hebrews 11:1? If there were a similar verse for sanctification, this would be the appropriate time to quote it. Instead, she quotes things like John 17:17, where Jesus says, "Sanctify them by your truth, your word is truth." That is not a clear explanation of the concept of sanctification in any way, shape, or form. It seems to assume that the reader already knows what it means. And so I had to resort to looking it up in the dictionary, which was a much more helpful book than the Bible in this instance. The dictionary defines it as set apart as or declare holy. There, that's much simpler than trying to figure it out from context. And that is basically that whole section. It's like a whole page long. And despite my and my partner's mocking of this tendency of the author of becoming the woman of his dreams to turning to dictionary definitions in nearly every chapter, in this instance, it could have saved some time. Also, we podcast our read-through of that book every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern on The Watering Hole, so check that out if you like. We have fun with it. She puts me in my place a lot. Back to the book, the next section is called Only Through Faith, in which she explains that it's faith, not works, that save people. She once again reiterates that it takes a comparison with the biblical law to make people see how unworthy they are when compared to God, and then she reverses course and goes on a tirade about how those who teach the self-exaltation version of Christianity claim that the sanctification happens instantly, and by this means, through faith alone, they reach perfect holiness. Only believe, they say, and the blessing is yours. No further effort is supposed to be required from the receiver, and so on and so forth. So after that rant, we wind up in a section called Biblical Sanctification, which once again doesn't actually explain what that even means, but whatever, the dictionary helped us figure that one out. But in this part, she tries to explain how to become sanctified. And you can't get sanctified if you have bad behavior. How many professed Christians are degrading their godlike manhood or womanhood by gluttony, by wine drinking, by forbidden pleasure? And the church too often encourages the evil to fill her treasury when love for Christ is too feeble to do it. And aside from her apparent disregard for the fact that the very first miracle Jesus is said to have performed was the turning of water into wine so that a drunken party could continue, I mainly quote this bit to contrast what she says two paragraphs later. Every year, professed Christians spend an immense amount of money on harmful pleasures. They rob God in tithes and offerings while they consume on the altar of destroying lust more than they give to relieve the poor or support the gospel. If all who claim Christ's name were truly sanctified, they would give their money generously into the Lord's treasury instead of spending it for needless and hurtful indulgences. So the church encourages evil simply to fill their coffers, but her admonishing you to fill the church's coffers instead of spending your money on fun things is done because reasons. Also, fuck off with that robbing God bullshit. I consume on the altar of lust regularly, but I also get audited regularly because in my country, run by a Christian prime minister and with a predominantly Christian population, I give more money to charity than is usual. And yes, giving to a church does count as giving to charity in Canada, so in theory, all these Christians should be giving 10% of their entire income to their churches. And the charities I give to do much better work with the money they get than churches do. I'd rather my money go to a food bank that is going to help poor families eat than a church's Help Pave Our Driveway Fund, which has a decent chance of winding up mostly in the pastor's pockets anyway. All that aside, my point here is to ask, since we're saying that people are consuming on the altar of lust more than giving to the poor, how does one weigh that? Is one sex act the equivalent of $1 that could have been given to the poor? Is it less? Is it more? Do we need to adjust for inflation? Do we need to gauge by time spent engaging in the activity itself? I don't think that last one's fair. Like, maybe it was a bit fair in Ellen's time, but with modern technology for most of the year, I don't actually put any time or thought into my charitable contributions. They just come out of my account automatically every month. It just seems like an impossible thing to quantify. unless I was spending money on sex, which, yeah, between toys and subscriptions, there is some of that going on, but I think no matter how you weigh it, my charitable giving outweighs my hedonistic proclivities to such a degree that the government doesn't believe me when I tell them about it. In the next section, which is called Direct Access to God, she says, "The stars tell us that there is a light in heavens whose glory makes them bright. In the same way, Christians reveal to the world that there is a God on the throne whose character is worthy of praise and imitation." To which I say, "The stars tell us that there are balls of gas burning billions of miles away."
I always thought they were balls of gas burning billions of miles away.
I mean, scientifically speaking, they tell us a lot, but none of it is that there is a light in heaven whose glory makes them bright. They're bright because of fusion. Atoms get smushed together under intense pressure, creating new atoms and releasing a bunch of energy in the process. But also, if the behavior of Christians is supposed to be an earthly representation of the character of God, then have I got some news for you about what has been made public about the behavior of Christians nowadays. There's sex abuse, there's other physical abuse, there's financial scandals, and a bunch more things. And while the Catholic Church is the easy example here, the Seventh-day Adventists do have their fair share of scandals too. And as with the Catholic Church, a big part of why it's scandalous is not just that it happens, it's that when the Church finds out about it, instead of reporting the perpetrators to the authorities, as would be proper, they try to cover it up to protect their reputation. Is this the character of God that you say is worthy of praise and imitation? To me, it seems like moral depravity, and I've already confessed to consuming on the altar of lust, so if I, someone that Ellen would undoubtedly see as morally depraved, think that the behavior of the Church with regards to his sex abuse scandals amounts to moral depravity, then what does that say about the Church? And yeah, this is in a section called Direct Access to God, where Ellen argues that Christians really do have direct access to the all-powerful creator of the universe. Could he not tip them off about future sex abusers when they're hiring church staff? Is that really too much to ask? Ellen seems to agree with me that the behavior of God's representatives on Earth should be exemplary, but the fact of the matter is that it is not, which then leads me to believe that if a God exists, it ain't the one that Christians believe in. Later, in this same section, she says, "These things are the fruits of Bible conversion and sanctification. It is only because people treat the great principles of righteousness shown in the law with such indifference that these fruits are so rare. This is why we see so little of the deep, lasting work of the Spirit that used to accompany the revivals." So, it seems that, even in the 1800s, Ellen recognized that the people who are supposed to represent God here on Earth did not have moral characters that would reflect her beliefs about the moral character of God. You'd think that she could have put two and two together there and then just realized that this might be because such a God doesn't exist. I wonder if she ever made use of the moral argument for God's existence, because this whole section of the chapter seems rather antithetical to that. Anyway, that's basically it. It's a bit of a short one today, which is funny because it's one of the longest chapters in the book so far. There's just so much repetition. Today's comment of the day comes just from Enigmatical Jedi 6808, who says, "Hey Rhino, you realize you are strawmanning the whole 'the Trinity breaks the laws of logic', don't you? I can be both a father and a son at the same time. I am still me, so A is still A, but I am also simultaneously a father and simultaneously a son." Well, Jedi, I actually feel like this is a bit of a straw man of my own position. The argument does not rely on the idea that one cannot be simultaneously a father and a son. Father and son in this argument are merely labels to keep the aspects of the Trinity straight. The problem is that the Father is supposed to be holy God, and the Son is supposed to be holy God, but they are supposed to be distinct from each other, and also there's only one God. So, this would be more like saying that you are identical to your son, such that between the two of you, only one person exists, and yet you are two distinct people. It's not about the labels, it's about the attributes. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to go to the link in the description to order your copy of Sometimes Illness Wins. I'll be back next Friday with more, but if you need to get your rhino fix in before then, I livestream with Cyrus every Wednesday at 8:30 Eastern, and with my partner every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern over on my other channel, The Watering Hole. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon and sponsorships manager, David for being this week's PayPal hero, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Zacuse and all the rest, who are the guilt that you should feel for not following the law that is my channel. If you'd like to be freed from your guilt, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!